Welcome to Perspectives. I'm Joan Herman. The almost mythical world of Antarctica could be on another planet for all its differences from the verdant North Coast. The continent that encompasses a landmass larger than both the U.S. and Mexico combined contains 90% of the world's ice and boasts one of the world's largest deserts. Yet for all Antarctica's differences, research being conducted there in all of the sciences has ramifications worldwide, including for those of us living on the upper left edge of the United States. One of my guests today is Dr. Scott Borg, who oversees Antarctic infrastructure and logistics for the National Science Foundation's Office of Polar Programs. He's speaking Sunday in a free program at 6 at the Astoria Senior Center about research going on in Antarctica. Dr. Borg holds a PhD in geology from Arizona State University and has been working off and on in Antarctica for nearly 40 years. My other guest is Dr. Erhard Gross, a retired linguistics professor who now teaches in Clatsop Community College's Encore program, an association of retirement-age folks who share a love of learning. Encore is sponsoring Dr. Borg's presentation, which is free and open to the public. This program was pre-recorded. Welcome to the studio, Scott and Erhard.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Well, for those of us who will never get to go to Antarctica, including myself, Scott, would you explain what it is like, if it's possible to summarize?
Well, when people ask me why do I like to work in Antarctica? Isn't it real cold? And I almost, my initial response is, well, there's no mosquitoes and no snakes, so it's a great place to work. And yes, it's cold, but it's a dry cold. And it's a fascinating place, both in terms of just the geography, the expansive scenery that one is exposed to, the opportunities for research. And because Antarctica is such a big part of the world, it is an integral part of our atmospheric and climate system. And so it's really important, I think, to understand how Antarctica interacts with the rest of the world. And then, of course, we can learn a lot of interesting scientific things by studying in Antarctica or studying things about Antarctica.
Okay, what are some of the various scientific research programs being conducted there now?
Well, of course, you mentioned the extremely large amount of ice. It's the largest amount of freshwater ice in the world. If all of the ice were to melt, sea level would go up. This is worldwide sea level would go up by about 60 meters, so just shy of 200 feet. Now, that's not going to happen in the next couple of decades, but the ice mass is changing. And one of the most important scientific bits of work that the National Science Foundation is sponsoring is to understand how that ice sheet is changing, how the mass of the ice is changing, how fast it can change, and therefore how fast it can contribute to sea level rise. But there's a lot of other research. There's organisms that live particularly in the oceans or in the coastal areas around Antarctica, and they've adapted to very cold, very extreme conditions. So the oceans around Antarctica get, you know, a lot of sunlight in the austral summer and a lot of darkness in the austral winter. So there aren't the normal cycles of plankton growth that there are in the tropical parts of the world. And that means that food sources for the food chain, the marine food chain, is quite a bit different. And of course, it's quite a bit colder. So organisms have taken various strategies to adapt to those kinds of extreme conditions, both the cold and the fluctuating sources of food for them. And they've adapted in interesting ways, and it's biologists are fascinated trying to study not only the adaptations, but now the genetic underpinning of those adaptations. And there's some fascinating stories along those lines. The interior of the Antarctic, because it has so much ice, the ice sheet averages about 2 miles thick. And that means the surface of the interior is at a high elevation. Being at a high elevation, it's cold in the coldest part of the Earth. And what that means is that it's a very good place for certain kinds of astronomy because there's very little water vapor in the atmosphere. And so for certain kinds of astronomy, it's just a superb observing place. Some people say it's almost space-like conditions that you can achieve in the Antarctic. And so there's a whole range of scientific work along those lines that goes on.
Okay, this may be a stupid question, but how does water atmosphere interfere with us here being able to study the stars and the planets?
Well, so energy that propagates, for instance, from a supernova or something like that, or stars, certain kinds of energy then will be absorbed by molecules in its pathway. And of course, out in interstellar space, there's dust in our galaxy, and that dust will interfere with the energy that's coming toward us. But in our own atmosphere, that's where the stuff that can interfere with our observing is really pretty dense. And it happens that water vapor will, so different materials will absorb different wavelengths to different degrees. And water vapor, as it turns out, will absorb energy in certain wavelengths that are very interesting for astrophysics. And so if you can find a place that's high and dry with only a little bit of water vapor in the way, then you can see more.
Okay, thank you. It's fascinating. And Earhart, I want to give you a chance to get in here. I'm curious, Dr. Borg, you're normally stationed in Virginia, aren't you?
That's correct.
So how was it that you happened to snag Dr. Borg to come and speak to us in Astoria Sunday evening?
I have the good fortune of knowing his mom.
Really?
Who lives in Seaside.
Small world.
And she invited us to kind of a private showing by Dr. Borg of what he does and having to do with the Antarctic. And so I took the opportunity and asked him if he would like to make a presentation to Encore. And he accepted immediately, and here we are. And this, by the way, happened in January or February of this year when we first met.
Well, that's wonderful. So what does Encore stand for?
Encore stands for Exploring New Concepts of Retirement Education.
But this program is open to anyone regardless of age?
No, you have to be 50.
But I mean the program Sunday evening.
Oh,
Dr. Borg's talk.
Yes, that program is free and open to anyone.
Great. And what time do the doors open at the senior center?
5 p.m.
Okay, and the talk starts at 6. And I understand you're going to have some slides as well?
Yes, I'll have some slides. I have a few movies. And, of course, a lot of people think of Antarctica and think of penguins.
Of course.
So I might have a penguin or two to show.
I wanted to get back to something you mentioned just a moment ago, Scott. You said that the ice is melting, albeit very slowly, in Antarctica. Do scientists know why that's happening?
Well, so the ice is changing. The ice mass is changing. There is melting going on in some places, and some of it is linked to the changes that the whole globe is taking place. The average temperature of the Earth has been rising. That's well documented. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is known to be an absorber of energy, and that contributes to global warming. There's a lot of discussion these days, as you might imagine, in terms of attribution, of just how much is attributable to human activities and how much is natural variation. And that's an important discussion to have. But the bottom line is that the Earth is on a warming trajectory right now, and that is affecting how the ice sheet is reacting to it. And so what we're interested in supporting research work on is understanding how fast the ice sheet is changing, because there's a great deal of uncertainty, how fast the ice mass is being lost, and what the potential is for acceleration or deceleration of ice mass in the future. You know, there is an idea that as the Earth warms up, there'll be more evaporation in the ocean. The atmosphere will transport that moisture somewhere and drop it as rain. So patterns of rain and patterns of desert are likely to change. And there is a, you know, many models show increased snowfall in the Antarctic. So then the question is, can that snowfall compensate for the ice that's lost at the margins to the ocean? And right now, there's good evidence that the ice mass is being lost at some rate, but there's a lot of uncertainty on just what that rate is.
Okay, all right. Another fascinating area that I know your scientists working under you have uncovered are two species of dinosaurs that went extinct few years ago?
Yeah, a long time ago. Of course, all dinosaurs went out at the end of the Cretaceous. But Antarctica, as you noted, is very large. If you put it in terms of a percentage of continental crust on the Earth, it's just shy of 9%, which means it's almost a tenth of the continental crust of the Earth. And that means that it will hold records of past life that are commensurate with 10% of the records that one can find. And there are sedimentary rocks. There were sedimentary rocks being formed, or deposits being formed, at the time that dinosaurs lived. In the latter part of the era of dinosaurs, Antarctica was in a very high southern polar latitude. And so, as it happens, some scientists have found a number of dinosaurs. And there are many more than two dinosaurs. There's half a dozen or maybe a dozen dinosaurs that are known from Antarctica. There are a couple of very prominent ones. But what these dinosaurs can tell us is that they needed a pretty robust ecosystem to survive. And so, and we can determine with some degree of confidence that Antarctica was in a high polar latitude. And one of the dinosaurs, a dinosaur called Cryolophosaurus, which is kind of looks a little bit, it's a Tyrannosaurus Rex-like dinosaur. It had a big head and big teeth and
classic
jaws
dinosaur.
And little front arms and that sort of thing. It lived around about 180 million years ago, but even then, Antarctica was in a high southern latitude, and the location where that dinosaur was found would have been about 65 degrees south at the time the dinosaur lived. But what that dinosaur tells us is that it must have had, to be a large carnivore, it must have had a large, robust ecosystem with vegetation, with smaller animals, and that sort of thing, for it to survive. And then that tells us that Antarctica at that time, even though it was so far south, was vegetated, didn't have a big ice sheet like there is now. So paleontological research like that does have a lot to tell us about how life evolved on the Earth.
That's fascinating. I'm curious, how are they able to find the remains of dinosaurs that lived 100 million years ago?
So I said that Antarctica is more or less covered by ice and that sort of thing, but there are places, the Transantarctic Mountains and mountains along the coastal areas, where rock pokes through the ice. And geologists know, paleontologists know what to look for. If you fly over an area and you see layers of rock and they're kind of light-colored and highly variable, But even thicknesses, that's a good sign that there's sedimentary rocks there. And then it's a matter of going and studying the rocks, determining what ages they lived in, and if there were rocks of the Mesozoic era, there's a decent chance, and particularly rocks that were sediments that were deposited in river environments or stream environments, sometimes lake environments, there's a good chance that you'll find evidence of the life that inhabited that area. Okay. So they go look for the right environments and then basically get lucky.
Wow, that was a great discovery. I'm sure they were pretty excited that
day.
Oh,
yeah.
If you're just joining me, you're listening to a pre-recorded interview with Dr. Scott Borg, who oversees Antarctic Infrastructure and Logistics for the National Science Foundation's Office of Polar Programs. He's speaking Sunday evening at 6 at the Astoria Senior Center about research going on in Antarctica that has ramifications for the rest of us. I'm also speaking with Dr. Erhard Gross, a retired linguistics professor who now teaches for Encore, the Clatsop Community College program sponsoring Dr. Borg's talk. I'm Joan Herman on Perspectives on Coast Community Radio. What other kinds of animals do you see typically besides the ones we know so much about, penguins, Scott?
In the Antarctic?
Yes.
Well, there are petrels that live in the coastal areas. There's a hearty seagull-like animal, bird, called a skua, and they inhabit coastal areas. They're larger than our typical seagull and sort of stockier and brown, and they're scavengers. But in the sea itself, the sea life is remarkably diverse. There are sea stars, there are scallops, there's a range of sponges and jellyfish. There are in the Antarctic Peninsula, which is the peninsula that sticks towards South America, there have been found king crab like crabs. So the sea life is actually pretty diverse around Antarctica.
And has the ocean temperature been affected at all by the ice melting?
So in the Antarctic Peninsula that sticks out towards South America, there has been pronounced warming, and the surface waters are the surface waters have been warming. Sea ice is disappearing a little bit earlier in the austral spring, and it's forming a little bit later. So there's less sea ice in the middle and northern Antarctic Peninsula relative to where it was in the 50s when the modern era of exploration and research started. And the sea ice is essentially a habitat for certain kinds of penguins. Some kinds of penguins like having lots of sea ice around. Other kinds of penguins don't like having sea ice around. So as the extent of sea ice changes, the penguin ranges will change as well.
Now, humans obviously could not live at Antarctica without a great deal of interference, so to speak. Who owns Antarctica? Is it a nation or nations?
So that's a very interesting thing, and we could talk for a long time on it. But there's no native population in Antarctica. Antarctica is governed under a treaty called the Antarctic Treaty, and there are a whole bunch of nations that have acceded to the treaty or signed on to the treaty. Basically, it holds the Antarctic. There were a number of countries, I think 8 countries, that made claims, territorial claims, early on. The treaty holds those claims in abeyance, which means they're not recognized, nor are they denied. But it sets aside Antarctica for peaceful purposes, for international cooperation and that. And the Antarctic Treaty came around in the idea of it came around after the International Geophysical Year in the late 50s, and it came into force in the early 60s, kind of at the height of the Cold War. And basically, it kept people from fighting over it, I think. And I think some people refer to the Antarctic Treaty as one of the early arms control treaties because it did, basically say, countries agreed to not fight over that bit of land.
So that has been successful in keeping it peaceful and non-territorial?
It has been. The treaty organization meets every year, and the countries that are active with research programs in the Antarctic actively collaborate and look for ways to share support and help each other out. So I think it's been very successful.
How many National Science Foundation scientists work at least part-time in the Antarctic?
So the National Science Foundation has a relatively small staff, and so in terms of NSF employees per se, there's only a few of us there each year. But we support research that's done by our universities around the country, and on average, we support about 150 projects a year. And those range from astrophysics to biology to geology, glaciology, and so on. And the size of the science project varies. Some science projects will have 40 people, and some science projects will have 3 or 4. So it's highly variable. But I'll talk about some of that stuff at the talk. And so please don't want to give up too much. Yeah.
All right. Earhart, I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit more about Encore. What other kinds of talks and programs does Encore offer?
We have diverse programs. We have done programs on, for instance, the Chinese in Astoria. We have done programs on Native Americans here, and we teach courses about that and have field trips. We do everything. We try to tailor our offerings in terms of classes and programs to a wide variety because we have people in our membership who are more interested, let's say, in playing cards or in dancing, in other words, physical education. And then we have some more academic programs, such as philosophy and history, and a diversity that attracts a lot of people.
Okay, that's great. And if people wanted to learn more about Encore, how could they go about doing that?
Well, they could call Encore itself. They could go to our website, which is encorelearn.org, or they could contact Mary Kemhis's office here at the college. She is the liaison.
Okay, I didn't catch her name.
Mary Kemhis. That's okay. Spelled K-E-M-H-U-S.
Okay. And what is the number for Encore?
We don't really have a number.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So the website's probably the best bet or trying to reach Mary.
That is correct. You could reach Mary, or from the website you can get the names of the people who are in charge of different activities, such as the membership committee, which is presently headed by Raleigh Lindstrom from Chinook. And we have members who will respond by sending to anybody who is interested the necessary papers in order to join.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Scott, how important is it that research continues at the Antarctic?
Well, I have a biased view, of course, but I think it's very important for a number of reasons. Some of the studies of organisms are telling us about how vertebrates work, and some of those things have ramifications to human health. And I'll talk a little bit about that at the talk on Sunday night. There have been, and of course, the question of ice mass loss and how fast it could happen in the future, I think is very important, because we all want to know whether we should build port facilities to last for 20 or 30 years or whether we should expect them to last for hundreds of years. So I think just to learn about how our Earth works as a whole, it's hugely important. You can't ignore 10% of the Earth and expect you'll understand the whole thing.
Well, and I'm curious, because it is such a frozen land, is it like a time capsule? If scientists were able to drill through that ice, would they discover lots of organisms the farther down they went?
Well, absolutely. Now, not so much in the ice, but in the ice in certain places is an accumulation of snowfall. And when you drill through that, you can get a record of snowfall that occurred in some places on an annual basis. And the snow represents the atmosphere from which it came. And so it actually is a very, very good record of past atmospheric conditions. The oldest ice cores that we have right now are around about 600,000 to 700,000 years old. It's not annual. There's not annual layers at that point. It's a much coarser record. But this record tells us about atmospheric composition. It gives us, it actually traps gas that from our atmosphere at that time. So we have a very, we have an unequivocal record of atmospheric composition for that time period. But one of the very, very interesting, most recent discoveries is an announcement just about 2 weeks ago at a Goldschmidt conference, which is a, you know, conference for geochemists and that, is there's good evidence that we've found a place where we have 2.7 million year old ice. And there is the chance that if we can get a record of you know, a 1,000-year record of what how our atmosphere was changing back then and what the gas composition was back then, 2.7 million years ago, that would be a of tremendous value to science. In terms of organisms, though, you can drill into sediments from the ocean in the ocean, and you can find lots of organisms in there.
Wow, that's pretty interesting to say the least. In your nearly 40 years working off and on in the Antarctic, have you yourself witnessed changes in the landscape or the life there?
So not directly because of the nature of my job. Attaching meaning to that is not quite fully scientific, shall we say. I experienced rainfall at McMurdo about 15 years after I had started work
and
there.
And explain, McMurdo is one of the big
research stations?
Oh, sorry. Yeah,
McMurdo is the main U.S. station on the coast of Antarctica, and it's about 77 degrees south. The U.S. operates three permanent stations, McMurdo on the coast, Palmer Station on the coast, and South Pole Station right at the geographic South Pole. But rainfall at McMurdo is very, very unusual. So is that a trend? You know, I don't think it's really evidence for a trend. But, for instance, the degradation of ice shelves on the Antarctic Peninsula are a pretty unequivocal set of changes that are associated with regional and global warming. And those have been observed, you know, the principal observations of those are from satellite, and they're spectacular.
So lots of work to be gleaned from that.
Yes, there's a lot of interesting things to be done, yes.
Well, thank you. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Scott Borg and Dr. Erhard Gross, for coming into the studio today and discussing the fascinating research being conducted in Antarctica. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very welcome. Thanks.
Dr. Borg oversees Antarctic infrastructure and logistics for the National Science Foundation's Office of Polar Programs. He's speaking Sunday evening in Astoria about research going on in Antarctica that has implications for all of us. I've also been speaking with Dr. Erhard Gross, a retired linguistics professor who now teaches for Encore, the Clatsop Community College program sponsoring Dr. Borg's talk. The talk, which is free and open to the public, begins at 6 at the Astoria Senior Center at 11th and Exchange Streets in downtown Astoria. The doors open at 5. This is Perspectives, and I'm your host, Joan Herman. Perspectives was engineered today by Joanne Rideout. The show can be heard every other Friday on the stations of Coast Community Radio. You also can find show podcasts on the station's website. If you would like to contact me, send me an email to perspectives@coastradio.org. Thanks for listening.